as it stands today, there are about 90 communities that have absolutely no law enforcement whatsoever in those communities.
Getting more village public safety officers to rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 1st of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, closing the commercial laundry at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center.
They're told when they come out here, this is a job. It's not just something to do. You know, we're training them in a work ethic.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Fostering safe, connected schools is a foundation for academic achievement through annual school climate surveys. Information at aasb.org.
Today is the official date for turning in the U.S. Census form, but it's not the last chance. Fairbanks Complete Count Committee Chair Catherine Dodge says there's a window to be included in the decadal population count.
The census is a snapshot of our community and our nation as of April 1. However, we have until April 19th to return our forms, and even actually after that.
People who live remotely have been visited and counted by census workers, and Dodge says those on the road system have or will receive a census form, either in their home mailbox or hung on their door. Forms are also available at local post offices. Dodge says one way or the other, it's important to fill out a form and get it in.
For every 1% of forms that are returned nationally, our nation saves $86 million.
Dodge says that's because any forms not returned by April 19th trigger costly residence visits by census staff. Meanwhile, she says an event that happened yesterday in Fairbanks was aimed at counting and helping the homeless.
We're working with the Census Bureau and all the local homeless service providers. We're offering things like haircuts and help with ID and credit checks and some lunch. And the goal is to enumerate the homeless in our community.
Dodge says the census form return rate is currently at 31% in the Fairbanks borough, 36% statewide, and 46% nationwide. She says the final return of all forms delivered to residences is usually around 63%. Bolstering the Village Public Safety Officer Program has been one of the cornerstones of Governor Sean Parnell's effort to make communities safer. Last year, the state funded 15 new positions statewide. Now Parnell's asking for another 15, and the Alaska legislature is on board again. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Contained in the Senate's operating budget, which passed earlier this week, is about $1.5 million to recruit, train, and hire additional VPSOs. The House budget also contains the 15 positions, so funding is all but assured once the budget hits the governor's desk. Joe Masters, the Commissioner of Public Safety, says that VPSOs are crucial to public safety in rural Alaska, and he points to statistics, which he says proves that point.
In communities that had VPSOs, not troopers, but VPSOs, the incidence for serious injury due to assault was reduced by 30%. The same study also showed that the likelihood for prosecution for sexual-related offenses and sexual assaults increased by 3.5 times.
Alaska State Troopers are stationed in select villages and often must travel sometimes hundreds of miles to respond to a call. But VPSOs live in the community they're tasked with serving. But Master says the majority of Alaskan villages are still without an enforcement presence.
As it stands today, there are about 90 communities that have absolutely no law enforcement whatsoever in those communities.
If the legislation clears the governor's desk, it would bring the total number of VPSOs from about 50 up to 86 in the last 2 years. Master says he plans to place them in villages with no VPSOs.
Certainly one of the main focuses are those 90. And then some other focuses will be some of the larger communities that have one VPSO where we'd like to add a second.
The state is also trying to retain the officers they have. In the past, the retention rate for VPSOs has been abysmal. Starting pay has now jumped $4 an hour, plus extra pay for parole and probation work.
Which is great, but that was only one part of it. The next part of it was giving longevity increases and performance increases throughout the year. So as a VPSO remained on the job and became more valuable, he also received more pay.
Master says since those changes have been implemented, the retention rate has about doubled. In the YK Delta region, Alaska State Troopers have also dedicated a trooper to work exclusively with village officers to coordinate between law enforcement agencies. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Voters will know who is paying for political advertising during this year's elections if a bill the Senate passed today becomes law. The measure is the state's response to a U.S. Supreme Court decision last January that allows corporations and unions to use their own money to pay for political ads as long as they're not done within the formal campaign structure of candidates. Judiciary Chairman Hollis French said the Supreme Court made a fundamental change in the way states conduct elections.
When the Supreme Court passed its recent decision, it changed the landscape of our political spending rules. And our state had a total ban on this type of spending. Our state, therefore, had no laws on the books about this topic. And both Ledge Legal and the Attorney General told us we have to do something. We have to pass some bill to cover this now big open gap in our laws.
The bill requires that those paying for advertising relating to candidates or issues identify themselves to the Alaska Public Offices Commission and identify themselves in the advertisement itself. The bill passed with no opposition, but North Pole Republican John Coghill had some reservations about the effect of the measure, particularly broadcast advertising where the sponsors must identify themselves in person on the air.
I'm afraid what's going to happen under this is we're going to not actually get good reporting, but we're going to have a lot of noise that actually loses the value of what we're trying to do, and that is, who is this really talking?
The bill next goes to the House, where it will be heard by the Judiciary Committee. Fairbanks Republican Chairman Jay Ramirez says no one in the legislature wants to stop the changes the bill makes, and that includes him. However, he sees what he calls prickly issues that he has already started work on, particularly with the identification measures that Coghill addressed in floor debate.
Look forward to tinker with it and make sure that it represents a point of view that's, you know, consistent with fair disclosure, but not so cumbersome that the ability to convey a message in 30 seconds is also lost.
Ramirez has scheduled the bill for a hearing next Wednesday. The Senate today approved a bill separating gas taxes from oil taxes. The issue arose when lawmakers discovered that under the current unified tax structure, the state risked actually losing as much as $2 billion per year when oil prices are high, as they are now, and gas prices are low, as they also are now. Petroleum economists predict that those conditions are likely to continue for as long as 20 years. Opponents to the measure, including the Parnell administration, say that if those market prices reverse, the state would take in much more revenue if the tax is not changed. Finance co-chair Sitka Republican Bert Stedman says the risk is too great, and he describes the current tax as a shell game.
I'm very concerned when we export our gas to Alberta, or even if we take it to Valdez and we ship it to China or wherever, that the state of Alaska isn't giving away this revenue stream on gas, that value, when there's no other. As far as I know, and we've looked at a lot of basins around the world, there's no other hydrocarbon basin of the magnitude of Prudhoe and Kuparuk and what we have in the Arctic that gives away its hydrocarbon. It doesn't exist. And when it does, there's social upheaval and there's changes in the government and things change. And I want to get ahead of the curve here.
Three members of the Senate voted against it but didn't address their opposition to the bill. It next goes to the House. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, 36 sacred artifacts are repatriated to Southeast.
They would use their shamanic objects and drums to beckon the spirits to come and heal the person.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The Alaska Marine Highway System is looking for a new laundry. Since 1985, inmates at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau have done all the laundry for 11 state ferries. But the State Department of Corrections proposes to close the facility in September. The Lemon Creek Laundry is the last of three prison employment programs being shut down by corrections because they're not making a profit. A garment factory at Highland Mountain Women's Prison and a furniture factory at Spring Creek Correctional Center closed yesterday. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander visited the laundry and brings us this story, the second in a series on the prisoner employment program.
It's the biggest laundry in southeast Alaska.
Lemon Creek laundry manager Don Kirstein says inmates move a lot of wash.
400,000 to 500,000 pounds a year. Last fiscal year, I think we did 479,000.
That takes about 12 inmates during the winter and 18 to 20 in the summer.
They're told when they come out here, this is a job. It's not just something to do. You know, we're training them in a work ethic. They get up in the morning, they go to work, they be there on time. Things have to be nice, they have to be neat, clean.
Lemon Creek Superintendent Scott Willard says Kirstein runs an efficient, professional program. The only one of the three prisoner employment programs that makes any money.
One kind of helps feed the other, you might say. And our laundry service is what's helped kind of keep it afloat. But with the expense just to keep this place running and with all the new equipment that is needed, DOC is kind of stuck holding the bag and it's too much of a strain on our budget.
State law requires the prisoner employment program be self-sufficient. The Alaska Marine Highway System pays Lemon Creek $400,000 a year to do its laundry, but the boiler has had issues for years, Willard says, and the washers and dryers wear out. The Corrections Department has not planned for any equipment replacement. Leslie Houston does a quick calculation.
That's $1,895 just for the boiler.
That's $1,895,000. Houston is Administrative Services Director for Corrections. She says each washer would cost $125,000 to replace, $75,000 for a dryer. Total replacement for the aging laundry is estimated at $2.5 million.
The money would have to come out of the prison employment program, and there just were not sufficient funds to reamortize the equipment.
Inmates in yellow uniforms weigh the dirty laundry before loading big blue Braun washer extractors that line one end of the 3,000-square-foot facility. In the center, an inmate is huddled over a sewing machine repairing tears in a garment. A long rack of white stewards and chef's coats hang nearby. A table is piled with pressed, folded white sheets.
Right behind you there, they're pressing pillowcases as we speak. That machine also folds the sheets. This machine on my right, it presses, it does not fold. But in the summertime, both these machines are running constantly.
State ferries are full in the summer, but AMHS Captain John Falvey says the logistics of moving laundry from Lemon Creek Prison to the Auk Bay Ferry Terminal are amazingly complicated year-around.
We have trucks that the state owns to move the laundry. The correctional facility has trucks. I think it's 8 or 10 total. You know, our employees are maneuvering the trucks around, and all this is very cleanly handled, you know, out of the port of Juneau with the ships, you know, coming and going.
Falvey is concerned laundry from the 11 southeast ships might have to be washed in various ports. A request for information from commercial vendors was due yesterday.
We do anticipate more cost, and we're just not sure where that figure would land.
If that figure is big enough, Corrections Leslie Houston thinks AMHS could save its laundry facility.
If it becomes too exorbitant for Marine Highways, quite possibly the money that they would be investing in, you know, the outside industry, we can turn around and invest in some new equipment. We don't know yet.
Closing the prisoner employment program hits the Marine Highway twice. The ferry system sheets, towels, blankets, and garments washed at Lemon Creek have been made for years at the Highland Mountain Sewing Shop. A quote from one outside vendor shows a medium chef coat would cost up to $33, depending on whether it was imported or domestic. The same coat made at Highland Mountain would be $9. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Environmental Protection Agency has granted Shell Oil the air permit it needs to start drilling in the Chukchi Sea. The permit covers emissions from the drilling rig Frontier Discoverer and all of its support vessels. Janice Hastings is Deputy Director of the EPA's Office of Air, Waste, and Toxins. She says the permit puts strict limits on Shell's operations.
We do a conservative analysis, assuming that they are emitting at what would be the maximum amount allowed. And then we do air quality modeling that looks at what you would expect to see in terms of concentrations at some distance away from the source. In the case of this operation, Shell is required to meet the air quality standards at the hull of the ship, so within a very short distance.
EPA Air Permit Manager Nancy Helm says they took into consideration comments from the public and during public hearings when they developed the permit.
Many of the comments did lead us to make changes to the permit. Especially the changes that you see between the August proposal and this permit, or actually the January re-proposal, emissions of several pollutants were quite dramatically reduced.
She says they reduced sulfur dioxide emissions 98% more from the original proposal and limited fine particulates by another 75%. Both are known to cause health problems. Hastings says Shell is required to monitor all of their emissions and the EPA has the right to inspect them.
The way that we assure compliance is through a number of reporting and record-keeping requirements in the permit so that they have to be checking on their operations, reporting on what they see. All monitoring reports come into EPA certified by an official who says that they are accurate. And, of course, if people are not accurate in the reporting, it is a very serious offense.
Members of the public have until May 3rd to challenge the permit as long as they address issues they've already made comments on in the past or elements of the permit that changed from the draft. If the permit is challenged, it will go before the Environmental Appeals Board. This permit is only valid for oil and gas exploration for Shell's leases in Area 193 in the Chukchi Sea. Hastings said the EPA will make a decision on air permits for the Beaufort Sea operations later this month. On Tuesday, Anchorage will hold its annual municipal election. Although the candidate campaign advertisements have not been as heavy as in recent years, this spring's voting will decide the political dominance of the Anchorage Assembly. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The current assembly is divided between six progressives and five conservatives, a division that often marks some crucial votes. It means that while Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan is buffered from veto overrides, he can also find administration-favored proposals thwarted. The five seats in this spring's election are currently held by two progressives and three conservatives. One progressive, Sheila Selcraig, and one conservative, Dan Coffey, decided not to seek re-election. Selcraig's assembly retirement has produced a three-way Northeast Anchorage contest between Paul Honeman, a moderate who ran for mayor last year, along with political newcomers Adam Trombley and Tom Purcell. Trombley has received considerable conservative support, including a contribution from Mayor Sullivan. Coffey's absence resulted in a three-way race between Dick Traney, Andy Clary, and Joshua Whitaker. The generally conservative Traney has previously served a little over 10 years on the assembly, spread over portions of three decades. He cites his experience. First-time campaigner Clary says it's time for new ideas. In his campaign literature, Clary aligns himself closely with the mayor's policies. In another race drawing considerable attention, attorney Matt Clayman, a progressive who served as acting mayor between now-Senator Mark Begich's resignation and Sullivan's taking office, is battling challengers Bill Siegler and Ernie Hall. Hall, a businessman, ran for lieutenant governor with Democrat Fran Ulmer, but in this race enjoys considerable conservative backing, including some former Republican mayors. Besides the five assembly races, there are two school board seats on the ballot, along with four municipal bond packages totaling just over $40 million. Citing the economy, The Anchorage School Board declared a bond holiday and has no propositions on this year's municipal ballot. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
33 sacred Tlingit artifacts are back in Southeast Alaska after spending nearly 150 years at a museum in Massachusetts. The objects include masks, rattles, tools, pipes, and a wooden warrior's helmet collected during the 1860s by Edward Fast, a U.S. Army lieutenant stationed in Sitka. Fast later sold the artifacts to the Peabody Museum at Harvard University. See Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Wuerl says most were used by shaman during healing ceremonies.
You know, a clan will go to a shaman and say, we have an ill person, and the shaman would have a ceremony. And usually they would use their shamanic objects and drums and rattles, you know, to beckon the spirits to come and heal the person.
Sea Alaska Corporation obtained the objects under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Many of them originated in Yakutat and were repatriated on behalf of the Yakutat Tlingit tribe. Wuerl says the tribe may let the Heritage Institute hold onto the artifacts until they have the facilities to care for them.
If the tribe or the clan wants us to care for the objects, then we will sign a memorandum of agreement whereby, you know, they give us that authority.
The objects arrived in Juneau earlier this month. Wuerl says Sea Alaska got a grant from the Interior Department to cover shipping costs. Fewer people rode state ferries last year. The drop in foot and vehicle traffic followed 3 years of increases. But officials say the numbers are coming back up. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Alaska Marine Highway System sold about 318,000 passenger tickets in 2009. That's almost 7% fewer than the previous year. The system also booked about 109,000 vehicles in the same period. That's a little more than a 1% drop. Ferry Chief Jim Beadle says the sluggish economy was a factor, but mechanical breakdowns and accidents had the biggest impact.
Some of the problems that you see in Southeast Alaska with the drop in traffic was, you know, 2 months of service without the fast ferries in May and June, the Sitka traffic, the Petersburg traffic, the Lituya traffic when it was out for a month.
The fast ferry Fairweather tied up with engine problems, and the Lituya went to the shipyard after blowing onto a reef. Most Southeast ports saw fewer ferry travelers in 2009. Only Angoon and Tenneke experienced increases, but most Southwest ports had more people getting on and off the ships. Beadle says Kodiak residents contributed to the increase.
They indicate their feelings are that it has to do with airplane fares. It's the increased charges and the decrease in the allowable baggage that you can take with you. That people are taking their rigs, going to Anchorage, doing shopping, and they're doing it because it's cheaper than it is on an airplane fare now.
The cutback in Southeast travel brought some worries. Wrangell lawmaker Peggy Wilson, who chairs the House Transportation Committee, says she's heard from a number of constituents.
Most of the people that have concerns are people that are in the tourism business, and their concerns about they're losing money, and they're seeing a downturn of anywhere from 20% to 35% of their normal patronage.
But Wilson, who also represents Petersburg and Sitka, is optimistic. She thinks the problem is the economy, not the ferries themselves.
Under normal circumstances, we would really be concerned about it. But under these circumstances, we're hoping that it'll pick up as the recession improves and things get better.
It looks like it already has. Beadle says 2010 numbers are better than 2009's.
We're not very far into the year, but our traffic is higher this year than it was last year at this period of time. And, you know, especially right now, we have a lot less ships even running, and the numbers are still holding pretty steady.
Ferry ridership began to increase about 4 years ago after 6 years of dropping numbers. Beadle says keeping the schedule consistent has helped.
People are figuring out how to take advantage of it. They're figuring out how to make it work for their businesses. And that's what happens when you have a consistent schedule, is people get used to it and they figure out how to make it work for themselves.
But ridership remains below the peak years of the early 1990s, when passenger numbers topped 400,000. That's 25% higher than it was last year. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A sure sign of spring. Canada geese are migrating north to breeding grounds in Alaska. The first geese showed up in Delta Junction Tuesday, and the Fairbanks Daily Newsminer is reporting two citizen sightings at Creamer's Field Waterfowl Refuge in Fairbanks Monday. Department of Fish and Game Creamer's Refuge biologist Lori Beck says the geese usually take a few days to get to Fairbanks after showing up in Delta.
The birds typically arrive during the second week of April. They've come as early as April 3rd in 2004. Both the 5- and the 10-year average, however, is April 9th, which is the day they arrived last year. But since they've been seen in Delta, it takes about 4 to 5 days before they arrive here.
Beck says fields at Creamer's Refuge are being readied for the arrival of geese.
We've got some fellows from DOT at the airport that come over and plow our fields to try to make more meltwater available for the birds and also just have a nice open brown space for them to land on. And then on Saturday, we have the Borealis koanas come out and give us a hand, and we spread about 2,000 pounds of grain.
Beck says the fields at Creamer's are closed to people during migration, and refuge visitors need to keep their pets on a leash. Up to a couple hundred geese per day will be arriving at Creamer's Field through early May to fuel up before flying on to summer breeding grounds on the Yukon and Tanana River flats. Other birds that stop over in Fairbanks include cranes, ducks, shorebirds, and snow buntings. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Rosemarie Alexander, Ed Schoenfeld, and Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.